following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Isn't being a good person enough? Well, the truth of the matter is that this question has to be broken down into its two components. There are two separate components involved in it. One, is it enough to be a good person? And two, is there such a thing? If one is going to make the assumption that you could be a good person without halacha, we would have to explore that assumption. And I think that we will discover that there will never, under any circumstances, be a person that we can agree is called good without halacha. Let's explore the second question first. What is going to give us a definition of a good person? Let's agree on that. A good person is one who what? Won't do harm to anyone else. Okay? Is that a good enough proposition for a good person? One who will not do harm to someone else. I think that everybody today, in our age, who has any pretensions to thinking in terms of a good person, agrees that a fundamental criteria is you can do anything you want as long as you do not hurt somebody else. Is that a fair statement of what the general approach of our time is? As long as you don't hurt somebody else. Okay? Let's assume as though they meant this. We'll soon show that they don't mean it, because, for instance, nobody is going to say you're a good person if you will not stop to help the victim of an accident. Right? You see somebody getting hit in the street by someone and you don't stop to help him, you're not a good person. Or for that matter, you were driving a car, you hit somebody. Well, you shouldn't have. I wish I hadn't harmed him. But I did. I'm not harming him anymore now. I drive off. Am I harming him anymore? I didn't intend to harm him. You can't call me bad when I didn't mean to do that. Now that I did it, I'm not harming him. I'm letting him sit there and die. So you mean a little bit more than not harming another person. You mean accepting some degree of responsibility. Now, what degree of responsibility? Deny yourself a swimming pool so that he could have a car? You know, to him, a car is more important than a swimming pool to you. He can't afford a car. You have a very good car, good quality. You want to build a swimming pool. Should you give him your money so that he could have a car? And give up your swimming pool? I think the majority of us would say no. It's my money, my swimming pool. Why give it to you for your car? Well, why do you have to take him to the hospital? You need some criteria. Well, let's go back. This, we all agree, that a good man will not do something that harms somebody else. I'm a good doctor of compassionate feeling, etc. I have lined up today in the clinic 7 patients. I'm going to kill 7 unborn children. Are you harming somebody else? Well, that depends on your definition. You know, is a child, an unborn child, someone else? If an unborn child is someone else, then I'm harming someone else. If an unborn child isn't someone else, I'm not harming someone else. Okay. It's a lot more convenient to define it as not someone else. I hereby am going to kill 7 unborn children today. Is that correct? How about a Jew? Is a Jew someone else? Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask an Aryan, a good, solid German, no, Jews aren't someone else. Jews are subhuman. If you're going to harm a Jew, that's not harming someone else. That's perfectly all right. We disagree. Okay. How about a black? Is it okay to harm a black? A lot of people will tell you, well, you can't really deal with them like, you know, like regular human beings. You know, they're not kind of primitive. No, you can't really. How about that? You don't agree. Well, I'm a South African. I do agree. Well, why do you tell me whether that black is someone else or not? I can't tell you whether that unborn child is someone else. Why can you tell me that a black is someone else? Because it's a horrible thing to discriminate on the basis of race. Who says? Why? On what basis? Because I feel that way. You're right. You're never going to be a good man. The question is, how are you going to feel when the chips are down? How are you going to feel when a real question comes up? Yeah, depending on your feeling, you'll do what you feel, not what's right, not what's wrong. Don't talk to me about being a good man. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Gandhi was a good man. Maybe. But he was perfectly willing to sacrifice the entire white race for the sake of his India, no question. It's his priority. No question. What do you sacrifice for which? What are the extents of responsibilities? What are meaningful responsibilities? Is it more important to be sure that your child has a good education? Or is it more important to be sure that Ethiopian children have bread to eat? What does a good man do? They all opt for make sure their children have an education, but did they really consider the alternative? To what extent do I hurt myself to donate money to Ethiopian children? 1%, 2%, a tenth of 1%. What extent? How much? They made, I read, I don't remember the amount, but a lot of money by putting out some records made by very famous singers or something. I am quite sure that the people who bought that record had in mind that they are involved in a tremendous philanthropic project. And that's the case. Why wouldn't you give the 5 or 6 or whatever dollars it is that you spent for the record without a record? No, you needed a record to make you aware of how good it was. There is no such thing as a good person. There is no such thing. Because if I am the criteria, my judgments, my feelings, my outlooks, I've given you this mushel before, but I'm going to give it again because it's so real, it's so immediate, it's so actual. Most of you are Americans, I believe, right? I don't know your parents, maybe not, but your grandparents, I want to tell you, were all pretty nasty, rotten, no good people who didn't understand the basic requirements of humanity. They were bigots. They were racists. They were sexists. They discriminated against blacks. They oppressed women. But today, thank God, the modern generation is so much more enlightened, so much more compassionate, so much more sensitive and full of feelings that they are not guilty of all these offenses. Is that reasonable? Is it really true that somehow or other the people of the 1960s were so much more compassionate, had so much more sensitivity, so much more devotion to the precepts of justice and morality than the people of the 30s. What revolution took place that enabled this enormous moral growth to suddenly flower? Isn't it a puzzle? Isn't there something that needs an explanation? But let me ask you, before that, do you remember way, way back before, the United States of America fought a war, a major civil war, the most intense war that mankind faced until the First World War. There was no war in the history of mankind where more people were killed, more destruction, more loss of wealth and blood than in the American Civil War. Why was it fought? You read the revisionist book for economic reasons. Don't believe it. It's nonsense. If not for the moral issue of slavery, that war would not have been fought. What was the issue? The issue was that you had the noble, compassionate, feeling people of the North who are not about to stand by and see the rank injustice, the horror, the brutality of slavery in the South. And you had those degenerate people of the South who were unable to understand this noble vision and who were prepared to do battle unto the death, literally, to preserve the noble institution of slavery. Now, doesn't it strike anybody as peculiar that the dividing line is the Mason-Dixon line? If you live north of it, suddenly your moral sensitivities developed, and if you lived south of it, somehow you became a moral monster. Is that reasonable? Must we look for some explanation by which to understand why the people in the North were so magnificent in their nobility and the people in the South were such moral monsters? And if we discover that in the North slavery wasn't efficient and it wasn't economically viable to maintain slaves, whereas in the South, with the cotton plantations, slavery was really economically needed, is it reasonable to say that this had something to do with the relative moral positions of the North and the South? I think it's very reasonable. The good men of the North are the men who could afford it. The evil men of the South, who thought of themselves as good and proper and right, happened to have other economic interests. Are they good men? The reason the children of the 60s marched to the tune of civil rights was that they were rich enough to afford it. The reason that their parents in the 30s were obtuse morally was that they couldn't afford it. Looking for a job was something, a major undertaking, and you didn't want blacks around competing with you for the few available jobs. You had to make sure they didn't get it. Isn't that the fact? Are there such things as good men? When there was a surplus of soldiers, the highest and most noble of people were those who would fight to the death in the name of honor. When kings discovered that they were losing too many competent soldiers, they prohibited the fighting of duels and proclaimed it to be murder. And today it's accepted as murder. Are they good men? Are you a good man when you kill to defend your honor? Or are you a good man when you refuse to enter a duel and face the contempt of all your contemporaries at your cowardice and your lack of honor? Who was the good man? And why do you say it? If you say A was the good man, on what basis? Do you say B was the good man, on what basis? Where are these good men? Who are these good men? How long did it take to train the moral, sophisticated, ethical, solidly built burghers of Germany to accept as being right and proper to murder and rape and destroy in the name of their superiority? How long did it take him, Hitler? 3 years to get a whole nation to accept that the good person is the one who will kill any non-Aryan. 3 years. Are there good people? Which good people? Are the good people the communists who, for the sake of right and justice, starved to death literally 10 million peasants in order to assure the collectivization of the farm? Were they good people or bad people? These people who had the determination and the guts to stand for the death of 10 million others, not themselves, of course, but 10 million peasants for the sake of the principle of a collective agriculture. Who were the good people? The ones who died or the ones who made them die? They meant good for the sake of the principle of collective, for the good of the nation and the state. We're going to let these 10 million people starve. It's hard. We suffer terribly. But we'll do it. And they did it. I don't know how much they suffered, but they did it. Who are the good people? You know how many said Stalin was a good man? A good man. Was he a good man? Was Lenin a good man? How many millions of people thought that Lenin was a good man? How many people still think that Lenin was a good man? In the hundreds of millions. In the hundreds of millions in China and India and Russia. In the hundreds of millions, there are those who scream and proclaim, Lenin was a good man. How many of you agree that Lenin was a good man? They are still in the hundreds of millions who say Stalin was a good man. How many of you are going to be prepared to maintain that Stalin was a good man? What are you talking about, good men? Which good men? On what basis are the good men? Now let's go a step further. Let's agree. We do need some criteria. by which we're going to measure the difference between the good man and the bad man. We need a criteria. And we're going to use the Torah as that criteria. The Torah is going to teach it to us. Where else can we get it? There's really no place else. I mean, that's the truth. There's no place else that we can have the axioms by which to judge who is a good man, who is a bad man. We're going to accept the Torah. But listen. The Torah tells us what is right and what is wrong in the relationships between one human being and another. And we'll apply them meticulously. When is it stealing? Look in the Torah and the halacha. When is it justified? Look in the halacha. When is it murder? Look in the halacha. But what do I need kashrus for? What do I need tefillin for? What do I need Shabbos for? What are they? The important thing is to be a good man. Right. We'll agree. We'll agree that to be a good man you need the laws and our Torah. We'll agree to that. We'll accept it. And when we want to decide what is the proper behavior in human relationships, we'll refer to that halacha. And Choshen Mishpat will be there on the shelf every day, and we won't move without Choshen Mishpat. We won't move. But what do you need a chayim for? What do you need Yeridaya for? Who needs those minutia of whether the milk fell on the pot or the pot but put on the milk, whether it was so much or that much, whether the shechita came from this side, or whether he pushed, or whether he stuck? What do you need that stuff for? I'm in perfect agreement. Choshen Mishpat is the basis of our life. But Ora Chaim, it's antiquarian. What do you need the halacha for? That's the next phrasing of the question. I suspect that that's the major phrasing of the question. We are prepared to say that we'll submit to God's judgments and teachings in those things that matter, in those things that are relevant. That we'll do. But in what I eat and whether I throw up the switch on Shabbos, that's going to make a difference to whether I'm a good man. How does that affect my being a good man? I'm keeping all the moral laws. I'm keeping all the ethics. That's what matters. I mean, that counts. And if you will point out that never, ever in the history of mankind has there been a group of people who kept the morals and the ethics who didn't happen simultaneously to be keeping the laws of Kashrus and of Shabbos, that's a historical accident. It's because the ones who didn't know Shabbos didn't know about the proper ethics, but we're smart, we do. So don't bring me proof from the fact that in the history of the world it never happened. Never, ever was there a group of people who maintained a consistent morality and ethics without simultaneously maintaining their other laws as well. Never happened. Accident. From now on it could. Okay. You're a businessman. You can make a lot of profit if you're not really all that straightforward. You're going to give up that profit for some technical good? Or you're going to find a reason why it's not really all that bad, even after you've accepted the halacha? You've accepted the halach. Right, but come on, for this technicality of not, of not saying a lie, I have to, and for that I'm going to lose a $20 million job. You're going to do it? You're not going to do it. $10 million? $5,000? $1,000? Where are you going to pull the line? But even if you start with the $10 million, how long will it take you for the 2 cents? And if you start with just a little bit of a lie, when will it go to outright fraud? You're not going to find an excuse as you go along. When the chips are down and you know that the things that matter is, this technical law, the so-called ethics, as against a major loss. Well, let me give you just a little bit of excuses that everybody heard, every one of you heard. The phone company has cheated in the millions. Can't be anything wrong with cheating the phone company. I'm just getting a little of my own back. Isn't that right? Oh, come on. I'm not doing him any harm. He's insured anyway. He'll get it back. You heard that one? Or these companies, these big department stores, they rob you right and left. So what if you rob a little bit? What's not pickpocket? Shoplift. So you take a little bit back out of them. They didn't do enough of theirs. You heard that one? You think it's much different than Whitey or Blackie has killed sufficient that I'm just getting a little of my own left when I kill one of them? Is that so bad? Then I want to ask you a bitter one. How do you give up and resist the temptation of a meaningful difference in your life and all you have to do is lie or cheat a little, rob a little, take a little? Will it harm him that much? He has $10 million. I'll take $100,000. To me, it makes such a difference. To him, it's a drop in the bucket. If you know that there's a Ribbono Shel Olam who is reacting to you, possibly, but unlikely, even if you know there's a Ribbono Shel Olam who's reacting to you, unlikely that it'll be enough to keep you from it, because you're going to have the most delicious answer of all. I'm going to make a lot of money. When I make a lot of money, I'm going to give so much tzedakah and maintain so much Torah. It's worth it. It's worth it. I'll buy myself out. That isn't the words you use, but that's the thought you have. I'll buy myself out from the Ribbono Shel Olam. I'll pay him back so much that in the end it'll be okay. Look how good, how much good will come out of it. You've heard that one too. But how about if I know this? That no matter what business I have, no matter what profession I have, my parnasa comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's the one who gives it. And there's no way I can get more, there's no way I will have less by stealing or refraining from stealing. By using fraud or not using fraud, it's no way that it can affect my parnasa. That comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Is it a lot easier then? So no, don't be silly. What are you going to make? I mean, you're not going to make that $1 million. If you go Kenegad the Ratzon Hashem, you're not going to make it anyway. If you're supposed to make it, you'll make it by dealing straightforward and honestly. Now you got a chance. If that conviction becomes real deep, you got a good chance. Conviction is halfway deep, you have a lesser chance. You all know what's involved in doing good. There are enormous difficulties, incredible temptations, because we're so flexible-minded. We have all kinds of excuses by which we point out that what we're doing is really not so bad. Only the first and second times. After that, you don't have to point it out. Why do you care if it is bad? You live with it too. You enjoy bad then. You know that. The first time a Jew murders, he'll be shaking. He'll be nauseated. He'll be sick. The third time, he's not even uncomfortable. The fourth time, he polishes his nails while the one is dying on the floor. It's only the first couple of times that you need to excuse it, to find explanations. After that, you don't even bother. No, there are only those who submit to the Ribbono Shel Olam in the full gamut of his halacha, to whom your Hodeya is as solid as a Rechayim, which is as solid as Choshen Mishpat. They're the only ones who might keep Choshen Mishpat. You don't have the good men outside of those who keep the halacha. You just don't have them. They don't come. But suppose you did. Let's go back to the first proposition. That theoretically it is possible to have a good man who doesn't keep the full gamut of halacha. Plus, good man now is in terms of his relationship with other human beings, right? Isn't there a dimension to be a good man that you have to relate properly to Kaviyachal, to your Ribbono Shel Olam as well? Can you be a good man only if you relate properly to your wife, but not to your neighbors? Is that a good man? Does a good man have to relate properly to other human beings as well? How about a good man who relates properly to all fellow citizens, but not to members of any other nation? Is that a good man? How about a good man who relates properly to human beings, but not to his Creator? Is that a good man? Well, then, the definition of good man has to be only in terms of what? Of not harming others. It's not good. It's safe. It's comfortable. Good has to be that there is an essence of real difference between one mode of behavior and another. It's not just more comfortable. It's not just more profitable for society. That can't be the definition of good. By the way, if it is, then nobody who is capable of breaking that proposition will refrain. A Napoleon will always ignore them because he's more comfortable if the rest of society keeps the laws, but not me. But even if you do, on what basis is that good? Your definition of good is one who doesn't hurt others. That's good? Well, that's not utterly evil. Is there such a thing as good? Is there such a thing as being, in the positive sense, good? Not if the only proposition is don't hurt somebody else. You can't find good. And do you see that the minute there isn't the criteria of good, the criteria of don't hurt somebody else, you're back to the beginning. Hurt, whose definition of hurt? How badly? Whose definition of somebody else? Remember, that's where you're back to. If there isn't such a thing as good, and if there is such a thing as good, You can't give it to me in terms of not harming somebody else. You got to give me some positive expression of it as well. You've got to give me some explanation by which I know that there is a reality called good, something actual called good. What is that? Where do I find that? Where can I find that in my relationship to some other people? How can there be good within human beings alone? What justifies the whole concept of humanity? There's got to be something outside of humanity that provides for humanity's worth and that makes it meaningful to say that you're good in the way you treat other people. Don't you see that? It's got to be. That's something outside of humanity that gives humanity value, that gives humanity purpose, meaning, dignity. Got to come from outside. And what is outside unless it's their creator? What else can give a human being a dignity if not that he is God's creature? But then you've got to relate to God. And how can you be a good man without relating to God? And where is the area in which you can relate to God if he didn't give it to you? And if he did give it to you, how can you be a good man if you ignore it? And therefore, whether you're talking in terms of even somebody who could maintain a basic humanity without halacha, he can't be a good man without it. But as we showed, you can't even maintain a basic humanity without halacha. And I will make this statement and ask you to research it, please, at your leisure. It is a statement that has been in print for almost as long as printing exists and has been in writing for some close to 700 years. A statement that was implied long before that, of course. And the statement goes as follows. Wherever you will come to a place where Jews did not function and teach and live Torah, you will come to a place the inhabitants of which are barbaric, cruel, and without any concept of good. That if there is a pretense on the part of the nations of the world towards goodness, towards justice, towards compassion, it came solely and only from being exposed to the teaching and the practice of the Jewish Torah. And in those areas of the world where there was no such exposure, there is no pretense of a criteria or of a practice of good. And over there you're subject to most heinous of tortures without a second thought. Research that statement. Look into China. Look into Africa. Look into those portions of the globe where the Jew did not penetrate, where he did not teach or live Judaism, to see the standards of good men to be found there. It is through the halacha of the Jew that the concept of a good man came into existence. And it wasn't an easy job. Do you know what the guy calls it? He doesn't call it a good man. He calls it a gentleman. There's a difference between a gentleman and a good man. The first proof there's a difference is a gentleman has to start off by being an aristocrat. A peasant cannot be a gentleman. You know already that you're not talking about a good man, because who would want to undertake the proposition that to be a good man, you got to be an aristocrat? To be a gentleman, you do. Therefore, their concept of a gentleman is very, very far from that of a good man. But more deeply, much more deeply, whether you're dealing with the noblest of Greek philosophers or the most practical of nation leaders, from the educated to the abysmally ignorant, men, women, children, everybody knows that the hero is the warrior. Everybody knows that to the brave belong the fair. Everybody knows. The fair know that too. She knows that she belongs to the brave. And if in the past few decades humanity has reached the point where there are tens of millions who will say that that is no longer true, they say it. But in their hearts of hearts, it's still the truth. They admire the ace who shot down 22 or 52, whatever the number is, of planes. They admire that great warrior, bold, an adventurous who took his machine gun and shot down so many hundreds of the foe. They admire him even more if he could do that with a tolerant smile on his lips while he is committing his mayhem. They will admire him even more if he tips his hat to his opponent as he drives in the sword. An elegance in killing, a graciousness in destruction. That's the true ideal, isn't it? By all of them, except those who've been affected by halacha. Those who kept Shabbos and Kashrus and Taras HaMishpacha and all the dinim of our Torah, they are the only ones who refused to accept as the ideal and the noblest and the finest expression of the human psyche is the one who could kill most efficiently. The bravest and the strongest who are able to face up to the enemy and prevail. No, they're not the hero. The one who was kind, the one who was learned, the wise and the good are the heroes of those who kept halacha. And if little by little by little, drip by drip over the centuries, the other nations of the earth have slowly, slowly come to appreciate that there is truth in this view, but they don't like it. They've come more and more to accept it, but they don't live it. And there is today perhaps those who have really accepted the reality that the wise is better than the strong, that the good is more meaningful than the strong, who no longer preach that the pen is mightier than the sword, but who have started teaching the pen is better than the sword. It's not mightier, it's better. It is better to use the pen, to use persuasion, to use teaching than the sword. That slowly, little by little, century by century, they have come to recognize and realize that there is truth in this. But only those who have been exposed to a Jewish Torah. You will not find this anywhere else. Nowhere. Nowhere else. Not by the Buddhist, and not by the Confucianist. Not by the Shintoist, and not certainly by the Christian. Not by the Muslim, and not by the contemplationist, the meditationist. Only by those who've been exposed to Torah. They're the only ones who will recognize that it is not the great warrior who is the true hero. He may be a secular Jew, but this is baked deep into his bones, and he will honor more greatly the professor of physics than the major general with the medals. But the rest of the world will run to greet the hero and not the mathematician. Will run to give honor and respect to the conqueror of humans, not the conqueror of mystery. That's where you're going to distinguish between your good man. Because a truly good man is going to respect Einstein more than Napoleon. You show me how many statues there is to Einstein and count them in comparison to the statues of Napoleon today, you will see where the good man is to be found.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.